Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, as well as spending billions on the U.S.-directed proxy war against Russia while Canada's healthcare system crumbles and tens of thousands live in the streets, the government here has two sacrificed relations with Russia and China and Iran and others for no apparent benefit. Well, sadly, the official opposition, too, has failed to perform its duty, as has the unofficial media opposition. What's left but individual efforts in both fields in the pursuit of peace? Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. Dimitri's interviews for TRNN are at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, among other places online. In April, Dimitri headed to Russia as a sovereign citizen of our Canada, strong and free, to gain firsthand knowledge of the country and its people. Now, starting June 19th, Dimitri is heading out across this country from Halifax to Victoria on the Making Peace with Russia, One Handshake at a Time tour. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Always a pleasure to speak to you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm always pleased to speak with somebody who's done all this traveling and survived the vagaries of air travel in our modern time. Well, the last time we spoke, you were getting ready. It was in March, and you were just getting ready for the Art of Peace, Seeing the World Through the Eyes of Our Enemies webinar that was in anticipation of your tour of Russia. Firstly, Dimitri, what were your first impressions of the country and its people?
Well, I just want to, you know, clarify to our listeners that the scope of my travels in Russia were limited relative to the overall size of the country. So I spent, I was there for a month. I spent approximately 20 days in Moscow, almost all of that in the central part of Moscow, which is actually quite large. Moscow's a huge city. Then I took a train, a voyage that lasted 28 hours from Moscow to Simferopol, which is the capital of Crimea. And then I spent about 10 or 11 days in Crimea. I went all over Crimea to the northern border with the Kherson region, to the Sevastopol, the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. I was in Yalta. And so that was the full scope. And of course, I took a train back to Moscow. So I can't speak, obviously, to conditions prevailing in other parts of the country. But what I saw was certainly not a country where there was any evidence of crisis. I saw no indication that people are, being subjected to considerable hardship as a result of the sanctions. The grocery store shelves were full. There were lots of people shopping. The prices were quite low by the standards of, goods that you buy in cities like Montreal or Athens, where I spend a lot of time. And people were out in the streets and seemed to be going about their daily lives as if nothing unusual was happening. At the same time, I did sense, and this is just sort of a gut thing, that there was a somber mood in the country. I certainly wouldn't have described it as festive. I think people, and this was confirmed by my conversations with dozens of people in Moscow and Crimea, people are certainly cognizant of the seriousness of this war, the dangers that it poses to Russia. Nobody is rejoicing in the loss of life, nobody that I spoke to or interacted with, at least. And I think my overall sense was that there's a strong sense of purpose, a seriousness about the mood within Russia, but at the same time, really no signs of crisis that I saw. And the other thing I should mention, Chris, is that Moscow was quite an impressive city. You know, I'd never been there before. My images of Moscow were formed by, the Cold War. I grew up in the 60s and the 70s, 80s, and the images that we were fed about the city, and I don't know whether they were accurate at the time, was one of were images of a very gray city, a very oppressive environment, highly industrialized, polluted. That's what I recall about what I was shown of Moscow when I was younger. What I found was a city that was extraordinarily well organized. The subway was quite impressive as any subway system I've ever seen in any Western city. The city at central Moscow was remarkably clean. I saw, relative to what I see in major North American and European cities, a relatively low level of visible homelessness. The police presence, I was expecting to see a much more visible police presence than I saw. I saw very little police presence. I mean, at least in terms of uniformed police. I see more police, uniformed police walking down the streets of, New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles by far than I saw walking around Moscow. And I did a lot of walking around Moscow. I must have done well over 100 kilometers in the 20 days that I was there. And so those are my overall impressions. I wouldn't suggest also. It was certainly not my sense that there's a lot of opposition to the Russian government. And why we can debate that, and perhaps people will make the case that it's not an environment in which Russians feel free to express their dissent. But if you look at the reputable polling. And particularly, I'd refer people to the polling agency Levada, whose management is quite critical of Vladimir Putin. It shows consistently high levels of support for the Russian government. And right now, I believe Vladimir Putin's support level is in excess of 80%. And what you see in those polls is consistent with what I heard in my conversations with Russians.
Well, we saw, sorry to step in, we saw here not too very long ago drones hitting the Kremlin and hitting the suburbs of Moscow. Did any of those events intersect with the time you were there?
Not in Moscow. When I was in Sebastopol, the air defense systems were activated and there were explosions in the sky over the city. I didn't see what exactly. I suspect that they were shooting at drones. The Russian air defenses. And certainly when I was at the border of Crimea and Kherson, there was very, very intense military activity. There were extensive fortifications, a lot of, weaponry being transported and soldiers being transported back and forth across the border between Crimea and Kherson. But within, Moscow itself, I did not see any signs of combat or warfare or attacks. That happened shortly after I left.
Well, I'm looking at your Twitter site and at Dmitry Lascaris, and you've got your pinned tweet says, in April, I traveled to Russia to meet with students, academics, members of civil society, journalists, and diplomats. In these meetings, the news recently was of the UK sending depleted uranium munitions into this war, and then the spectacular ammunition dump explosion that was presumably of many, if not all, of those munitions. Now the United States is promising, I read, to do the same. What do these Russians that you were talking with, how do they react to the continual escalation of not only the amount of weapons, but the type of weapons being sent into this conflict and aimed at them?
Well, every single person I spoke to, and as I mentioned, I spoke to dozens of people, as you indicated, students, activists, diplomats, people from think tanks, academics, just ordinary Russians. Uniformly, their view is they're not at war simply with Ukraine. They believe, and I think this is a genuine, you can debate it all you want, but I think it's entirely sincere. They believe genuinely that they are at war with NATO, that the entirety of NATO is waging war upon Russia, and that its goal is not simply to destabilize the Russian government, but to fatally weaken the country as a whole, and if possible, to bring about its disintegration. So that it would never pose a challenge to Western hegemony. I think that is absolutely the prevailing view within Russia. And I think that these constant escalations, you mentioned the depleted uranium, Chris, of course, we were told that they weren't going to supply tanks. Then they started supplying, their highest caliber tanks, the Western states. We were told they weren't going to supply fighter jets. Now they're talking about, it seems quite clear they're going to supply F-16s. We were told they weren't going to provide long-range missiles. They broke that assurance as well. So there's absolutely no trust amongst the Russian people, understandably so, towards Western powers. They believe they're at war with the West. And I got absolutely no sense that they are prepared to sacrifice on the core objectives of this military intervention in order to placate the West. They're determined to prevail. And this puts us in an extraordinarily dangerous situation. You know, we have to find a way to talk with the Russian people and their representatives about their legitimate complaints, and at the same time raise with them the legitimate concerns that Ukraine has and Western states might have, and find a mutual accommodation. It's absolutely essential because we are on a trajectory towards nuclear war. That's where this is heading, and no one should have any illusions about that.
Yeah, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Dmitry Lascaris, and Dmitry is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and with the Green Party of Quebec. You can find his writings at therealnews.com and at dmitrylascaris.org. Well, as per NATO and their objectives here, I wonder, well, yes, to destroy Russia, but to what ends? Is this just as a stepping stone towards a greater conflict, a World War III? I think the Chinese share all of the opinions and fears misapprehension about NATO's long-term aims, as they do in Russia.
Of course they do, and they have every reason to be deeply concerned in China. You know, if you look at the State Department, the U.S. State Department's website, you can see that officially the United States government pursues a one-China policy. And as a matter of international law, Taiwan is part of China. They're the same country. Taiwan is not an independent state under international law. But while the U.S. government is paying lip service to this one-China policy, its conduct is completely undermining the one-China policy. It is supporting sovereigntists in Taiwan. It is arming what is in effect a pro-independence or maybe a covertly pro-independence government in Taiwan. It just recently sent trainers, military trainers there. It's inserting, along with the cooperation and complicity of Western allies like Canada, military assets into the Taiwan Strait. Just a couple of weeks ago, an American and Canadian warship entered the Taiwan Strait and were met aggressively by a Chinese naval vessel, which warned them off. So the U.S. government is clearly setting its sights upon China, which is the big prize at the end of the day. It is China, which from an economic, and you look at their military spending, population, technology, which poses the biggest challenge to Western hegemony. And as long as the Russian Federation and China are aligning their efforts in order to bring an end to this era of U.S. hegemony, I think at a certain level, the neocons in Washington are aware of this. It is impossible for the U.S. government and its Western allies to impose their will upon these two countries. The combination of their technologies, their natural resources, their populations, their economic activity, their industrial base, makes them effectively impervious to Western domination. That's not to say that they are in a position to dominate the world. The United States and its allies remain extremely powerful, but they are no longer capable of being dominated as long as they are working hand in hand. And so I think it's very clear from the conduct of the U.S. government and the even statements of some of its less discreet and subtle officials that the ultimate goal here is to weaken China, and that the Ukraine war is a stepping stone to that. And if we, by some miracle, Chris, at this stage, it would be miraculous if we avoid World War III between Russia and NATO, the way things are going. But if by some miracle we get through that, we ain't going to get through a military conflict between China and the United States. I think at that stage, we're basically finished. So we all need to come to our senses here. We need to give our heads a shake and realize that we are on the path towards self-extinction. That's as simple as that. That's where the United States government is taking us, frankly.
Well, this whole six is nine world is astonishing to me. I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised after being at this for so long. But our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, is lecturing Russia about stealing Ukrainian property. Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson for the Russian government, outlines that there. She says, and I'll quote her, that the AN-124 aircraft, which was delivered COVID-19 medication to Toronto under a humanitarian project at the request of the Canadian government, was prevented from leaving the airport and was essentially taken hostage. It now turns out that the Canadian authorities had a far-reaching aim in mind to steal this unique aircraft and to hand it over to their clients in Kiev, as well as what monies and everything might be invested here. The Canadian and American government, and I presume other NATO governments, are just practicing outright theft.
Yeah, you know, Chris, when I was in law school way back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I took contract law, as all of us did in first year, what we were taught about, you know, the English common law system, which forms the basis not only of the UK and Canadian legal systems, but also the American legal system, the Australian legal system, the New Zealand legal system, is that a core principle of the UK common law system was the sanctity of contracts. Sanctity. That's the word that they used. These agreements between private parties are commercial agreements, are to be respected and enforced by the courts to the letter. And the function of the courts is just to make sure that they are respected and to provide remedies when they are violated. What we have basically done in the West, you know, in terms of our dealings, not just with Russia, we also did this with respect to Venezuela, for example, and the assets, the gold assets of its central bank. We've done it with other states, but this time we've taken on one of the largest economies in the world, and we have basically made a mockery of the principle of private property, the principle of sanctity of contracts. And the result is that the Global South is fed up, absolutely fed up with reliance upon the United States dollar. It is the, you know, the status of the United States dollar as the global reserve currency, which makes it possible for the United States to basically engage in economic blackmail with countries around the world. And so what the United States is doing, I mean, the level of incompetence, I mean, just putting aside the immorality of the U.S. government's behavior, the sheer level of incompetence, it's an extraordinary, a French president, I think it was Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, once said that the U.S. dollar's status as a global reserve currency was un privilège exorbitant, an exorbitant privilege for the United States. It created a huge demand for U.S. currency. It enabled the United States government to borrow massive amounts of money at very low rates of interest. And it gave them a vice grip over the U.S., the global financial system. Now countries in the global south are saying, we've had enough. We are going to trade in our own currencies or maybe a basket of currencies, and we're going to render ourselves impervious to U.S. economic blackmail. That's what's happening. In the long run, these petty acts of theft, just stealing assets of foreign governments that happen to act in ways that the U.S. government finds disobedient, is going to undermine the status of the U.S. dollar, and that will have catastrophic consequences for the U.S. economy in the long run.
Well, and we've seen the U.K. government seize assets held in their British banks of Venezuela. The Americans hijack oil tankers from Iran on the high seas. Melanie Joly is not finished, though. In a press release from her ministry talking about taking the Syrian leadership to the International Criminal Court, she assures that, quote, we remain committed to upholding compliance with international law and call on all states and the international community to support accountability efforts for Syrians, but not presumably the Syrians that the Canadian forces dropped bombs on or the ones that were killed by the proxy soldiers of ISIS and the other extremist elements within the country. And another instance of a proxy war that started and supported by NATO.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how the Ottawa Press Gallery doesn't like fall over in uproarious laughter whenever they hear these kinds of statements coming.
Maybe they do,
but they don't do it publicly.
So, that's for sure.
You know, they actually take it seriously and they repeat these statements in their reports without a hint of skepticism. When they're afforded an opportunity to ask questions to people like Melanie Joly, which would easily expose the hypocrisy and dishonesty of these statements, they systematically fail to take advantage of those opportunities. And what am I talking about here, Chris? Well, let's just look at the United States. We all know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the invasion of Iraq was based on a pack of lies. We all know that now, that with after the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, that we were lied to about Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction, about his regime's involvement in 9/11. Those were a pack of lies. It was so obvious to the German and French back then that they refused to participate in the invasion of Iraq. And we also know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the Bush administration engaged in torture. How do we know this? We know this because Barack Obama himself, when he was running to be president in 2007, admitted that the CIA at black sites and at Guantanamo had engaged in torture. And he then proceeded to render impervious to prosecution all of the people who were involved in that torture and who authorized it. When did the Canadian government, in the 20-plus years that have elapsed since these crimes began, when did the Canadian government ever call for accountability for the Bush administration? When did it ever call for the ICC to indict George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or Condoleezza Rice or Donald Rumsfeld? Never. Not once. In fact, I don't know of a single person in all of Canada's parliament, either from the governing party or from an opposition party, who publicly called for these people to be arrested and sent off to The Hague to be tried for war crimes, even though we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that they committed war crimes. So we can say with an absolute certainty that Melanie Joly is flat out lying when she says to us that her government's motivation for demanding accountability for the Russian government is a concern for human rights and international law. The Canadian government has again and again, and I could go on and on about its sale of weapons, you know, to Saudi Arabia, about its conferral of trade benefits upon Israel's illegal settlements, an apartheid regime. I could go on and on. It's very clear that there's something else going on here. This is not about protecting human rights. It's not about democracy in Ukraine. This is all about geopolitics and global hegemony. That's all it's about.
Well, Melanie Joly also, in another tweet that I was trying to find earlier, and maybe she pulled it off out of some sense of embarrassment, but she was remonstrating against people that would profit from this war, which is like a bad joke. I mean, to anybody that understands the dynamics of the military-industrial complex and Canada's growing role in that, both domestically and abroad. Dimitri, yeah, there's way too much that we could talk about, and I don't want to lose sight of your appearance, your tour, Making Peace with Russia, One Handshake at a Time. You'll be here, as I mentioned, June 27th. But the location here is not being announced. You have to go and sign up at dimitri/lascaris-making-peace@eventbrite.ca before you can find out where it's being held. Why the secrecy, Dimitri, and what does that say about our democracy here?
Well, the efforts of, you know, people who support the NATO narrative about this war, which is frankly a pack of lies, their strategy is to deplatform us. And in fact, this is exactly what's happening. You know, in London, Ontario, which is where I'm starting my tour on my speaking tour on June 19th, and that happens to be my hometown, the organizers decided to take a different approach, and they actually publicized from day one where the event was going to be held. And sure enough, the venue has come under intense pressure to cancel. And in fact, I've been shown, you know, some emails from a member of the legal profession who appears to be closely associated. I'm not going to mention his name for the time being. He knows me personally. He's never raised any concerns with me about my advocacy around the war. He appears to be connected to the right-wing and pro-war Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. And he has been pressuring the venue in London, Ontario, to cancel the event. You know, and what I don't really understand, you know, Chris, is why somebody like that, you know, he's a lawyer, he's a very accomplished litigator, he knows how to articulate an argument. If he believes that I'm so wrong and he's so right, then why doesn't he just engage me in a debate? Why wouldn't we just have it out publicly and have a debate? Why is he going behind my back and pressuring the venue to deprive me of an opportunity to speak to people in my hometown in London, Ontario, about this existentially dangerous war? The reason why he's engaging this behavior, and others who support the NATO narrative engage in this behavior of trying to deplatform us, is because they can't win an honest, open debate. And they know it at a certain level. And so they're trying to silence us. And that's why we have to take, you know, regrettably, some measures to try to at least limit the amount of harassment to which, you know, the owners of these venues are subjected by this pro-censorship crowd.
Well, Dmitry's tour, Citizen Diplomacy with Russia, says the poster, One Handshake at a Time. You're going to be speaking, as you say, kicking off in London on the 19th of June. The 20th in Toronto, is that right? Oh, Hamilton, sorry, on June 20th. Toronto the 21st, Winnipeg the 22nd, Regina the 23rd, Vancouver the 26th, Victoria, as I mentioned, on the 27th, back to Montreal on the 29th, Halifax on the 30th, and Fredericton on July 2nd, and Ottawa finally on the 3rd. I hope you're keeping track of your frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a challenge to get all those speaking engagements done in that short a period of time. But, you know, I think, Chris, I mean, I'm privileged to be in a position to be able to do this. You know, they're not paying me any speaking fees. No one's going to reimburse me my travel expenses. I'm fortunate to be able to commit myself to this task of, you know, trying to present an alternative point of view to that of the Canadian government in regard to this existentially dangerous war. And I hope that people will come out, whether you agree or disagree with me. I invite you to come. You know, let's engage in an honest and productive and respectful debate. Let's not, you know, try to silence people or vilify people into silence. That's not the best way for us to conduct ourselves in a democracy and to ensure the future of our children.
Well, it's a very dark direction that this country has taken. And Melanie Joly's, when she was damning those that might profit from the war, there was, I took it, a distinct hint that people like this program who take alternative views to the what I view as propaganda coming from the CBC and from all the corporate news and from the government, especially governments of NATO, could be somehow construed to be profiting by this. It's certainly not financially or in the esteem of most of the people I meet and talk to, but that they might be targeted too. And that seems like a reality on the horizon here in this free country, Canada. Again, Dmitry is heading on the road on the 19th. He'll be in Victoria on the 27th of this month. Good luck on your tour, Dmitry, and thanks a lot for coming on. Can you just recommend quickly how people can find out more about what you're doing?
The best place to, you know, follow my writings and, you know, my activism is on my website, dmitryliskaris.org. I'm also very active on social media, particularly Twitter, and my Twitter handle is at Dmitry Liskaris. You know, and if you really just want to chat, you know, send me an email through my website. If you want to talk about these or other issues, you know, and I try to be as accessible to, you know, people who follow my writings as I can be.
Well, and I really appreciate the time you spent coming on this little show as well. And I want to thank, too, Tamara Lawrence. She's going to be here as well on the 23rd in Victoria on her similar tour of her talking about her recent experiences in Vienna with the Peace Conference or Peace Summit there. Thanks a lot, Dmitry, for coming on again, though, eh?
Thank you, Chris. I hope to see you soon. Take care.
And ugly news on Guerrilla Radio at guerrilla-radio.com. That's Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every week.